Welcome to Cross Border Tax Talks, where we discuss the latest trends in international taxation, from Pillar 2 to the latest on macroeconomics and geopolitics. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services Global Leader. The Pillar 2 engine from PwC is a game changer for Pillar 2 modeling, provision, and compliance calculations. Built on a graph system utilizing over 20 years of international tax technology, this centralized rules engine is built by a team of Pillar 2 tax experts from around the globe. PwC's Pillar 2 engine is currently available as a service and will be licensable in July 2024. On this week's episode of Cross Border Tax Talks, we're back at PwC's International Tax Conference in Dana Point, California, recording in front of a live studio audience. All right. I'm excited to welcome Dr. Alexis Crow back on the podcast. Alexis is a partner and global leader of PwC's geopolitical investing practice. Prior to joining PwC, Dr. Crow taught at the London School of Economics. Alexis, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
So Alexis, you recorded your first Cross Border Tax Talks podcast at our International Tax Conference in March of 2019, 5 years ago, seems like eons ago, before the pandemic. Interestingly, it's my most viewed video on YouTube. A lot has transpired since then. So before we dive in, what's one thing the pandemic taught you from a macroeconomic perspective?
Thanks, Doug. And it's an honor and privilege to be back here with you all in sunny California. One thing that continues to stun me is the fact that in the wake of the pandemic, nothing was too small to fail. In other words, we saved everything. We went in, the Fed went on a buying spree for junk bonds and ETFs to stabilize the market in March 2020. Speaking with a French senator, we saved the croissant shop, you know, in Paris. Everything was saved, and that really continues to surprise me.
Yeah, I mean, everything's going to be okay. We just need to sometimes remind ourselves that. All right, well, we're going to actually test that theory here over the next 30 minutes or so. Let's start with economic activity in general and the outlook for recession, both in the U.S. and globally.
Sure, so it's interesting. In 8 years of doing my annual outlook, which usually ruins New Year every year, when I was down in the trenches, and even a little bit before, I started working on it in November, and I shared with our chairman and our global chairman both. I said, gentlemen, for the first time, I am pretty optimistic on the U.S. economy and for 2024. And the U.S. looks relatively uncorrelated with the rest of the globe, certainly uncorrelated with Europe in terms of economic performance. And some of the driving forces behind this, of course, 70% of our GDP is coming from consumption. And the U.S. consumer, although the consumer is in a recessionary mindset, they're still spending across income brackets. And so, you know, when we think about that component of economic growth, I think even labor markets have remained quite robust. Wages have remained quite robust here. And so I would say the U.S. is looking quite bright. In Europe, of course, more deeply exposed to the energy crisis that has transpired, really going back to an over-reliance on renewable energy 2021 onwards, and then the energy shocks from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So industrial production in Germany continuing to plummet, and that being the largest economy in Europe, obviously weighing down on the Eurozone. China, in a different, very altogether different price basket than the rest of the world, going through deep deflation, and is likely to export this deflation, which we can come to around the world. And then other bright spots, India, we just had Q3 GDP come in surprising to the upside. And so one of the fastest growing economies in the world, even looking to the Middle East, non-oil based GDP growth in Saudi has been impressive over the last few years. And even looking to Brazil, where we've had a lot of political change, you have strong macroeconomic indicators on the table there.
Yeah, you mentioned the term a recessionary mindset, because it does seem like things are going relatively well in the U.S. from a macroeconomic perspective and even globally. And I appreciate this really isn't a macroeconomic question, but why the recessionary mindset? Is there any, do you have any views on kind of what I almost view as a misperception on how the overall economy is doing? But to your point, people are still spending.
Sure. I mean, I would say that the price shocks that households have witnessed in the wake of the pandemic, predominantly those supply-driven inflationary shocks, the bottlenecks to supply chains that we witness, finally some of those getting resolved in late 2021, and then Russia's invasion of Ukraine again upsets the entire price basket. So many households, particularly younger households, have not had any exposure to inflation in their entire life or their entire sort of adult life. So I think those sustained price shocks have really undermined the perception of purchasing power. Another component of that, one-third of CPI, the Fed's preferred measure for inflation, is related to shelter costs. And despite mortgage rates having over doubled since 2020, we still have record high house prices in the U.S., we still have record high rents. And so this measure of affordability and the crisis of affordability is actually going up for households and increasing. And so I think that's really also adding and weighing to the mindset.
All right, so let's double click on the inflation point. Is inflation under control now? Maybe again, starting in the US and then looking globally.
So Doug, we've talked about this 2 years ago, and I've been a long proponent and that we are been in largely a supply-side-driven inflationary environment. If you go back to 2020, we came into COVID within a price war within OPEC. Oil production dropped by the single greatest amount in post-war history in 2020. And then as we started to reopen, demand significantly surprised to the upside because everyone thought, oh, no one's going to move around. The car was dead. The car was certainly not dead. Everyone got back into automobiles and into rental cars, driving up inflation. And we also saw a serious rebound in domestic air passenger traffic in lieu of international travel. Domestic air passenger traffic picked up in Brazil, China, Russia, the US, where we hit IATI numbers from 2019 during Omicron. And then I would say we actually saw significant, many people participating in the conference here have been responsible for this. We actually saw pricing significantly coming down with regard to moving goods in 2021 because a lot of people started investing in smart logistics. Catena X, for those in the automotive industry, is a great example of that, where you saw automotive producers coming together in Europe and saying, we're going to actually use AI to track our devices that are moving across and pool together knowledge to get things more efficiently in place. Then, of course, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And if we look very closely, liquid fuels are very closely correlated to foods and metals. And so we saw a significant price shock here with regard to just the spike in energy prices. Now, that's moderated somewhat, and of course, we've seen headline inflation coming down, core inflation meaningfully coming down. Now, as far as where we go from here and how quickly it takes us to get there, we've seen a little bit of an uptick in the U.S. With just the latest data from January, probably related to some nominal wage increases at the start of the year. But I think we are on the comfortable trajectory of coming down, provided we don't have some sort of meaningful escalation in the Straits of Hormuz or the Middle East conflict at the moment. And of course, as I mentioned, China's in the other side, in deep deflationary. So consumer prices in deflation mode, producer prices in deflation mode, housing market obviously weighing significantly here, where we've seen values on residential condos drop in some cases 30%. That is obviously creating a different dynamic.
All right, so let's move to central banking policy and particularly interest rates. You mentioned the highest mortgage interest rates that we've certainly seen in our adult lifetimes. I hear from my mom about the 1970s when they first bought their house. But what are your views on central banking policy in the U.S., and then we'll look to some of the other regions?
I will just highlight there, it's interesting. We drew charts of debt service payments as a percentage of disposable income in the U.S., and by average, we're at 9.8% right now of disposable income, which if you look at the decades that your mom was mentioning or my old mentor at PwC, like this double-digit rates, you know, it's a very, very different phenomenon. So again, that's contributing, I think, to why spending is still somewhat resilient. So coming to central banking policy is so interesting because a lot of people, like geopolitics has become the buzzword and the hashtag for so many people setting up geopolitical practices. But really it's monetary policy that moves financial markets. It's really the cost of money that moves financial markets and equity markets in particular. And so it's fascinating. We've all become addicted to the FOMC meeting minutes. We've all become addicted to what happens at Sintra for the ECB, if you're looking at Europe. And so here, what I would say is that the Fed's credibility has been on the line. The ECB's credibility is on the line. So to the extent that market participants have been over-exuberant about the potential for rate cuts is very, very clear. So our forecast back in December was that you could see one rate cut, perhaps two, starting in the summer of this year in the U.S., 25 basis points. Actually, Rafael Bostic from the Atlanta Fed has also just highlighted this. He says probably looking at one. And so I would say that you're holding higher for longer, and particularly in the European situation where you have a deeper exposure to the energy crisis, so a stickier price environment with regard to energy costs is meaningful and concerning. I think what's also notable here is we all focus on the G3 and everybody's always looking at the Bank of Japan as well. But what's notable is that central banks in emerging market developing economies were very nimble in response to, first of all, in restoring price stability, shoring up households and companies with the provision of, like in the case of the Reserve Bank of India, dollar liquidity, a lot of mechanisms that we put into play to stabilize markets in the wake of the GFC were used by some of these emerging market developing economy central banks. And so what we've seen was those banks were some of the first to start the hiking cycle, and therefore they have more room to go. And so that's important to note, because whereas we faced these extraordinary twinned health and economic crises related to COVID, to date, we've not experienced a financial crisis, and that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. All right. So kind of maybe sticking with the potential crisis theme, the commercial real estate market and financial stability. A lot of this in the news, a lot of speculation post-COVID, you know, trying to get people back into the offices, empty downtowns throughout the U.S. Talk a little bit about how the commercial real estate market impacts financial stability.
Well, it's so fascinating, right? Because first of all, what's in a word? Commercial, by the Fed's definition, multifamily residential real estate is included in commercial. And so what's happening is everybody's scared about office real estate. Everybody looks at the, you know, empty skyscrapers that we have, particularly where I live in New York. We have these kind of just desolate buildings in Midtown East.
You should come to St. Louis.
And so everybody's scared about office, and then the rest of the real estate investment and development baby gets tarred by this office brush. And so that's a real challenge for those who are in PE and real estate in the room. That's a real challenge if you're an investor or developer these days. Which again, it's funny, because if we have housing formation needs, crisis in affordability, record rent, shortage in supply, you'd probably be wanting to go into residential if you were gonna be investing. But the case of office, it looks very different in the US versus the European market. Something we wrote about last year. When we started looking at the difference of the capital stack as well as the assets themselves. So in the US, occupancy rates, from the demand standpoint, occupancy rates continue to nosedive. And if you contrast that with Asia Pacific and with Europe, we are just continuing to nosedive. I heard a wonderful acronym, which I will not repeat, in the UK for what is defined as Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday workers. But what's fascinating is that may result, and we looked at this right at the start of COVID, and I was speaking about this with a real asset executive. We saw in PwC what flexibility did to office space, right, at the start.
For sure.
Because we were already doing that. We had, you know, office Fridays, clients the rest of the week. So if you had a three-day office week, not work week, but office week, then that could result in a 10 to 15% decline in footprint, potentially, which should result in a 10% decline in pricing. But we saw no price declines. And we're only starting to see that pocket to pocket. It's just happening in Chicago right now, which is fascinating. So we saw no price declines. Why? In part because nobody wanted to realize mark-to-market losses. And so we've been in this frozen asset price landscape. You saw a little bit of distress at the start of COVID where some European banks offloaded some assets. You have one distressed advisor coming in with one of the largest landlords in New York, ready to pounce on assets that have demonstrated any distress. But I would be concerned from the demand standpoint. Also, when you look at the building stock, as I mentioned, what's fascinating is office buildings in Europe, for the most part, have been developed for la longue durée. They were built for to last centuries. Whereas a lot of the office stock that we have in the United States is built in what I refer to as the aesthetically lean 1970s, which nobody wants to sign a lease for that because nobody's going to incentivize young staff to come into that to that office space. Then the capital stack. This is where the financial stability piece comes in. If you look at the exposure to specifically not commercial, but office and office-anchored retail in the United States, who's holding the bulk of those assets as well as the debt stack? It's the small to medium lenders. So all of that risky lending was pushed out of the globally systemic important banks and it's in the small to medium lenders. What did we experience a year ago? Tumbling of the small to medium lenders. So I think what we're seeing in terms of downgrades, loan loss provisions quadrupling for on behalf of some of those with deeper exposure, I think is meaningful. And again, that's in contrast to Europe, where we've had a bulk of those assets and capital are being held by the globally systemic
employer. Yeah, there's certainly been a lot of news recently in the U.S. with potential exposure to the small and medium-sized banks for that reason. All right, let's move to currencies and the future of the U.S. dollar. Is that in jeopardy, Alexis?
It's fascinating. And one thing I think that's important to note, and we're not even going on the crypto road here.
So. No.
One thing that's important to note is there's been a lot of chatter as to whether or not the dollar retains its lure and luster as the world's reserve currency in the face of credit downgrades from the ratings agencies on behalf of the USG, in the face of our deficit hitting a record $1.7 trillion. There is just a large bipartisan lack of concern with regard to having a balanced budget, or whether or not challenges that we face from a potential overuse of sanctions in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine have prompted central banks and emerging market developing economies to rotate out of dollars and into gold. So have all of these things threaten the role of the greenback? And what I would say it's important to distinguish is the role of the dollar as a reserve currency versus the role of the dollar as a unit of trade finance. And as a unit of trade finance, 90% of foreign exchange transactions around the world denominated in dollar. Yes, you are seeing chat from Lula going to China, talking with President Xi about settling things RMB and Khayesh. You are seeing the Saudis talk about this, just settling energy in RMB. So I think you will see some discussions of this, but with regard to the role of the USD as reserve currency, there's this wonderful acronym, we might have talked about this in previous years, TINA. There is no alternative to the US dollar. And really the RMB has held flat at 3% of reserve currencies. You only really saw the dollar give way to the euro after the inception of the euro in 1999, so it gave way slightly. But we've held flat at about 59% of global reserves. And I don't see that status disappearing anytime soon. What's interesting to note is that even when the IMF castigates the United States for its total negligence with regard to managing a fiscal deficit, the doomsday scenario economic case always has the dollar strengthening because everybody's crushing into the dollar as a safe haven.
Yeah, you mentioned sanctions as one of the potential exposures or issues for the U.S. dollar. One of the things that we have been talking about here at the conference is some of the global tax policy, in particular Pillar 1, and whether it has a realistic shot of actually moving forward. And if that doesn't happen, the proliferation of digital service taxes, and that one of the reactions that the U.S. government could have to our big tech companies and, you know, similarly situated companies would be these new digital service taxes, which could then cause the U.S. government to react through tariffs. And so it'll be interesting to see if tax policy ends up driving, similar to sanctions, these tariffs, potential pressure on the U.S. dollar. All right. So this is one of my favorite things that I do when I have you on the podcast is we go around the world and we've got 10 different stops. We're going to start in the U.S. and we're going to end in the U.S. on the election. But let's start with the U.S. and its policy with China.
What's fascinating is I was speaking about this with Chairman Kemp, who you'll hear from later. And what's fascinating is everyone's so focused on what happens if Trump comes in. And I've heard a great Japanese phrase, which is moshitru. which is Moshi in Japanese is if and through Trump. So what if Trump is the kind of dominating boardroom discussion? What's interesting to note is what happens to the Hill is one key question that will be tackled. What happens to the Fed is another critical question, especially in light of what we said on monetary policy moving markets. So those are important things to focus on. Another is that in the United States, what are the facets that make this an alluring destination for capital in spite of what changes happen or in spite of what dysfunction and gridlock that we might face in pushing through policy reforms? So we can end on that.
All right. Second, Japan, or did you already cover that one?
No, we're long Japan, and I've written about this for years. It's fascinating. the Nikkei continues to rise in contrast with regional peers and indices, in part because of the weak yen. Weak yen has driven significant profits in the automotive sector specifically. And I would certainly be focused on wealth management if I was in Japan. If I'm also an OEM, I would be looking at Japan as the single largest producer of patents in the fuel cell and energy storage space in the world. So I would certainly be looking at Japan.
All right, let's stick with Asia. India.
Yes, so India, not the next China, but is certainly billed often to be the next China. Again, one of the fastest growing economies in the world. We're looking at the elections. Of course, the BJP likely to storm ahead there. The Reserve Bank of India has held, I would say, a remarkably steady hand at ensuring price stability, which has been important given the fact that India is so deeply exposed to energy shocks and price shocks being a net importer. And I would be focused on India becoming that next part of the global manufacturing supply chain. Not the next China, but certainly where the production of high-skilled manufacturing eventually goes.
All right, what about Vietnam?
Vietnam, yes, very exciting. I call it the Switzerland of Asia because in the face of U.S.-China tensions, it is very much its own distinct civilization that sits in between the two countries. As one Vietnamese policymaker told me, he says, Alexis, I have an American phone in one pocket and I have a Chinese phone in the other pocket. And it's serving Vietnam very well. Even from the consumer standpoint, this is the 13th most populous country in the world, 90 million people, low dependency ratio. And I would be very much focused on catering to the consumer and the growing consumer base in Vietnam.
All right. So you mentioned, you said that Vietnam was the Switzerland of Asia. What about Singapore? From a tax perspective, I may have said that Singapore was more the Switzerland, but what about Singapore from a macroeconomic perspective?
Oh, fantastic. I mean, you know, what's interesting, we did a study back in 2018 for a client who was going to open their first Asian office. And they said to us, would you go to Singapore or would you go to Hong Kong? And for a number of different reasons, we guided them to Singapore. And I think what's played out geopolitically in the region has continues to drive this conviction home. Of course, for workforces that are present there, you are facing an affordability crisis in housing. But I would say that historically, there have been two gateway cities to Asia from the West and vis-a-vis the West. And those have been Hong Kong and Singapore. And I would really say that Singapore is in pole position today.
All right, so now we're going to move to South America and Brazil. As you know, I was in Brazil last week. Incredible amount of tax law changes through their transfer pricing policies, major changes to indirect taxes, potential corporate tax reform. But I think what was interesting as I sat down with taxpayers is an excitement about them kind of really embracing international tax norms. But what is the outlook for Brazil from a macroeconomic perspective?
Well, it's so interesting because when I would talk about a relatively positive macro story in Brazil, I'd always have the tax professionals look at me and sort of throw things at me in the boardroom. And of course, Brazil being notorious for having the greatest amount of filing on, you know, looking by OECD standards, the amount of hours of filing.
They're trying to slim that down.
It's been coming down. And should this, you know, excise and consumer tax then get pushed to income and corporate, I think it will come down. And I think that that's meaningful. The fact that this passed through the Senate, I think is very, very meaningful. We continue to see actually relatively strong macroeconomic indicators coming out of Brazil. I mentioned at the very start, the thing that shocked me in the wake of COVID was that we saved everything. Some governments used fiscal policy to support manufacturing activity in a very creative way in the wake of COVID. Okay, we said contact intensive services were all off because of the risk of contagion, but Brazil is one such country. employment in manufacturing actually increased by the greatest amount in record in October 2020. And we continue to see consumption hold steady in Brazil. What's interesting from a wealth management standpoint is that as the Selic rate came down in 2019 onwards, and then in the wake of COVID, a lot of people have wanted to come into wealth management products. So private markets significantly growing in Brazil. So I'm actually quite bullish.
All right. What about the Middle East? A lot going on in the Middle East.
Yes. Tragically so, in some circumstances. I would say that the status of the Middle East is we are in a fragmented world geopolitically. We are not in a bipolar world. We are not in a new Cold War. There's very much an element of fragmentation, according to which the Middle East has retained a relatively non-aligned stance with the U.S. I think there are two key factors behind this of why, for example, when Jake Sullivan called the Saudis and told them to turn on the taps and start producing more oil to address Europe's energy crisis back in 2021, the Saudis and the Emiratis have not necessarily been acquiescent. One of these is shale oil production, which continues to hit historic highs in the United States. The second was the Abraham Accords, which I think prompted the U.S. to withdraw slightly from the region. And now that latter point is, of course, held in a state of flux. Nevertheless, we're continuing to see clients double down on investing in Saudi Arabia, notably one tech hardware producer has committed to building servers there to build out its supply chain resilience and to be closer to end markets. Also, with growing norms around data localization, to be able to place yourself toward those industries. And so I think that that's meaningful. What is happening in the rest of the region is, of course, a tragedy.
Yeah. Let's move to Europe, an incredibly challenging regulatory environment for a lot of taxpayers from a tax and other perspective going on in the EU. But what does the macroeconomic outlook look like for Europe in general?
It's interesting when you're sort of having chat with people about geopolitical or geographical asset allocation, there's like a sort of grumbling that happens. And it's like, yeah, the U.S., everyone's investing in the U.S., it's dysfunctional, it's fine. Europe, there's no growth, so we have to go elsewhere. And you sort of skip over that. But everybody still focuses on Europe. I would say that if you gave me $100 million to invest today, I would be long Germany. Of course, you have industrial production, as I mentioned, completely tanking. Some production meaningfully moving offshore in the face of higher energy costs, which will have structural impacts. But I certainly always counsel people to position themselves in France, certainly if I was in the consumer space, technology space, as well as hospitality, it being the most visited country in the world, I would be positioned there. Also, Spain continues to surprise to the upside with regard to tourism and even pharma. And so I think government policies have actually been quite meaningfully positive there. The UK, which one could have considered to be classified as European, I would say is continuing to suffer deep macroeconomic shocks related to Brexit. These were billed as the fault of COVID, but they are certainly the shocks faced from a withdrawal from the EU.
All right, so let's move back to the U.S. then now, specifically focusing on the U.S. election, potential impact on the economy, and I'm specifically interested in immigration, innovation, and infrastructure, the three I's.
So these are my three I's, which again make the United States, render it totally investable in the face of political change. And it's fascinating. Of course, they're three interrelated. With regard to innovation, we're now the second country in the world with a generation of patents right behind China. We think about the extent to which MSAs such as San Jose continue to generate the most patents in the United States. And so I would certainly be focused on innovation here. We think about where our economies are going, some of the greatest innovation that actually happens in the U.S., in the clean tech and the biotech, pharma life sciences space, I think is meaningful. With regard to immigration policy, fascinating to know, we came into COVID with a labor shortage in key sectors. I was speaking with a real estate developer who could not get construction workers to develop a hotel in Las Vegas and would go to Seattle and poach workers from projects and bring them back into Las Vegas. So when we talked about labor shortage just in the initial reopenings of the economy, we stuck ourselves in the foot with immigration policy. And so something there has to change. I am hopeful that the United States, which is a country that has been completely built on immigration, will have this going forward. And of course, that's directly interconnected with innovation. The third piece on infrastructure is fascinating because we direly needed a restructuring of how we privatize assets and how we invest in infrastructure in the United States. And the IRA, misnamed though it is,
right,
completely restructured that. And I think that's actually very positive because it's inviting more private participation into direly needed infrastructure projects. And so to the extent that those cultural changes stick, which from everything that I understand are likely to do so given the benefits of the IRA for the red states, I think that that's going to be meaningful.
So how much do you, in your view, Alexis, does who ultimately gets elected president really matter in your three eyes?
No, I think everyone's focused on the characters. Everyone's focused on the characters. And like I would say, I would counsel what happens to the Hill with the ability to pass policies. What happens at the Fed with regard to, again, how much monetary policy moves markets. And so I'm going to be focusing on those two. Definitely.
It's a great point, and it's advice that I give to a lot of my colleagues in Europe, particularly as the Biden administration, for example, has been working with the OECD. We sometimes have to remind people that Congress actually enacts the laws in this country, not the executive branch. All right, so last topic, energy transition.
So fascinating from a taxation standpoint, right? Because the biggest proposals you see on the table are using tax in a punitive stick way or in an incentivizing carrot way to change behavior around how we use carbon in our economy and how we consume it. So fascinating from the tax standpoint. What I would say here, and it's not just because I worked in energy investing prior to joining PwC, is that we are very much in the energy transition, not the climate revolution. And if anything, the energy crisis that we witnessed in Europe really drove that home. And so you are seeing some European banks walk back their net zero commitments and say, look, we can't look at the world as if it was 2021 anymore, because 2022 ushered in a different era. Now, if you're also thinking about a fiduciary duty, many have actually said, maybe I'm not going to divest hydrocarbons that quickly because of the returns and because of the demand and what's happening to demand. So there I would say is what's interesting is from a portfolio standpoint is where's the lowest cost production of oil and natural gas happening and how is it most efficiently being produced and most efficiently being used? And that's where I think a lot of the investment advantages will be. With regard to where we stand, I do believe that Europe is the spiritual home and the spiritual vanguard of the climate revolution. But again, the energy crisis has held some of these great green ambitions in check. The U.S. is the one jurisdiction more than anywhere where I hear board directors and management teams question whether or not delivering on net zero goals can actually be in contrast with fiduciary duty. Then I would say what's interesting too is that you have some companies that are sort of semi-sovereign in the Middle East. I'm thinking of one in Morocco. I'm thinking of several in the UAE and Saudi, which can be some of the largest investors in the transition, even though they've been focused on more traditional forms of energy.
All right. Well, to wrap things up, Alexis, let's leave the audience with what is one thing you're hopeful about?
One thing I'm hopeful for is increasing female labor force participation rates. So we've seen a lot of these tank during the COVID pandemic years, of course, with a lot of women being caretakers at home and so needing to walk back from work. But meaningfully, on a fiscal side, we have seen significant changes to policy to be able to include more women in the workforce. And that's certainly a no-brainer and one thing I'm hopeful for.
All right. Well, Alexis, always a pleasure having you on. A lot to take in there. Thank you very much for joining.
Thank you.
So thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Cross-Border Tax Talks. Thank you, Dr. Alexis Crowe, PwC's Geopolitical Investing Practice Global Leader. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services Global Leader. Stay tuned for another exciting edition of the Cross-Border Tax Talks podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.